Committee, welcome everyone. So we have a lot of folks who want to testify today, so we're going to get started. Members are kind of drifting in, but we can start without a quorum. The committee legislative assistant is printing more agendas. I understand we're out of them, so we'll have that for folks shortly, but we do have so many folks who want to testify that I want to get started. So we are going to start with Commissioner Cunningham from the Department of Health, and then we're going to let the commissioners give us their testimony. And then when we get to other testifiers, because we are so restricted on time today, we have so many people who want to give us testimony, we're going to ask people to stick to 90 seconds per testifier. If we do not get through our agenda and let everyone who signed up testify, we will have to come back at 6 o'clock. So, you know, in consideration of letting people, everyone get their testimony in and not making some folks come back to testify, I would ask everyone to be brief. But we're going to start with Commissioner Cunningham. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Good morning, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. So nice to be back with you all today. Thanks to you and the members of the committee for putting in so many late hours and in weekend hours to get this Health and Human Services omnibus bill. I appreciate the inclusion of so many sustained investments for improving public health in the bill. Thank you for this bill's sustained investments, both in public health infrastructure and in emergency preparedness. As the last few years have taught us, public health has never been more critical, and you can't wait for a pandemic or another emergency to make investments. Public health has historically been underfunded and ends up being in a cycle of panic and neglect. We appreciate the legislature's investments to create a public health system that works for everyone, everywhere. This includes new investments for local public health, for tribal public health around the state, as well as new investments to maintain a strong foundation for emergency response. While the importance of public health has never been clearer, the importance of investing in prevention cannot be understated. We spend 80% of our healthcare dollars treating chronic diseases. These are diseases that can and should be prevented. In public health, we want to prevent illness and death by going upstream with partners whenever we can. We know that prevention saves money, saves time, and most importantly, prevention saves lives. I greatly appreciate your efforts and want to highlight MDH priorities included in this bill. If we want to address the growing burden that healthcare is placing on our state budget, we should be doing what we can to keep people living longer. I very much appreciate the investments in making sure everyone can achieve their optimal health. We are all troubled by the Minnesota paradox. We're one of the healthiest states to live in for white Minnesotans, but also have some of the worst disparities for Black, American Indian, and other Minnesotans of color. Thank you for the new tools that will help us to address some of these troubling disparities, including statutory establishment of the Health Equity Advisory and Leadership Council. And thank you as well for new funding to continue the work of our Office of American Indian Health and the establishment of a new Office of African American Health. We also know that we can only be successful if we partner. With strong partners, we can deliver public health strategies to improve people's lives, their families, and their communities. Important and successful grant programs like Community Solutions, Healthy Beginnings, and the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline are just a few of the grant programs that support our key partners to deliver important services to Minnesotans. Finally, I appreciate the inclusion of the operating adjustment for the department to help us maintain our current service levels. This funding represents support of the people we have, represents improving our technology, and will allow us to continue the oversight that we want for fiscal stewardship. Thank you, Chair Liebling, and to this Health Committee for your efforts in creating this bill, and thanks for your investment in prevention in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Commissioner Harvstead, welcome. And I, we do have a quorum present.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members. I really just want to say thank you this morning. I'm deeply grateful for this committee's seasoned and community-connected understanding of the health and human services needs across Minnesota and your willingness to invest generously to meet those needs in this historic budget year. A robust package of investments to continue building Minnesota's behavioral health infrastructure to make sure the sector is able to meet the growing needs of Minnesotans coming out of the pandemic, including key investments in children's mental health. I want to commend the Star Tribune for its thoughtful and data-driven examination of the behavioral health crisis that will take all of us from federal to state to county to plans and providers to solve together. Funding to support access to oral health, because as we have learned, there is no health without dental health. Investments to, as that our medical director, Dr. Chomolo, talks about, build equity into the walls of Minnesota's public health care programs and ensure that children do not have their health care interrupted throughout the year. Funding to support tribal nations, urban Indian, black and brown communities to deliver culturally specific care to their communities. Addressing deep poverty by increasing the monthly benefit for general assistance for the first time since 1986 and investing in programs to support people experiencing homelessness. And given your responsibility for our central office infrastructure, I am deeply grateful for your understanding of the need for investment in strong, stable state government. Investments to improve and maintain DHS operations and expand compliance and continuous improvement activities that are making DHS stronger every year. Funding to meet increased demands for background studies to make sure these are at least burdensome in a time of workforce shortage. Funding for IT systems work to transform human service delivery into an integrated, person-centered experience for people receiving services and to relieve burden on counties, tribes, and providers. Again, thank you for the wisdom and understanding of Minnesota's health and human services system reflected in this budget proposal. If we have any minor adjustments or corrections to address, to suggest, we'll address those in final budget negotiations, but they're not worth mentioning today compared to just expressing our gratitude at the opportunity we all have to support all people in Minnesota to thrive in our communities and contribute their gifts to our economy. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Representative New Brindley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a note as we move forward, I suspect all of us here would be happy to come back this evening to make sure that folks who have come to testify and prepared their 2 minutes have their 2 minutes to testify.
Well, we'll see how it goes, Representative New Brindley. I mean, I think, we've asked everyone to also, or invited them to submit testimony, and I would just say that if people still have testimony to submit, we will certainly be glad to take that. I personally often find written testimony to be, you know, equally useful, but, you know, I certainly respect everyone's desire to come talk to us as well. So,
Madam Chair, I would just point out that it's going to take me more than 2 hours to get through the written testimony, so I'd be happy to come back and listen.
Well, I hope you'll do both, Representative New Brindley. Read that as well. I mean, you know, people took the time to write it, and I'm sure there's more than 2 hours of work in it. So anyway, we're going to move on here. First on the list is Elena Niehoff, and I'm going to ask folks to come up. I'm going to call the next name and would ask both people to come to the table so that we can save some time that way. So Ray Parker, if you would also come up to the table. And then next will be Sue Abderholden and then Dr. Jess Meehy. So please come up and welcome, and please begin your testimony. And introduce yourself for the record, please.
Madam Chair and the committee members, my name is Elena Niehoff. I speak in opposition to Omnibus Bill, specifically Section 15 of Bill HF 91, because this bill plans to repeal Minnesota statute on reporting requirements. The U.S. House of Representatives Committee on Commerce conducted a hearing on March 9, 2000 on human fetal tissue trafficking. This statement is a congressional record. The committee has received information indicating that a market of the fetal tissue exists and that the federal law has been violated. Also, the Center for Medical Progress had done a journalist investigation into the Planned Parenthood and multiple groups affiliated with abortion clinics in California, Texas, Arizona, Florida, Washington, and other states. Their investigation revealed the black market of the fetal tissue of the procurement industry exists. The role of the government is to place safeguards into the laws and to prohibit any nefarious actions. My question, knowing the existence of the illegal fetal tissue black market in the country, how do the authors of the bill, HF 91, plan to prevent, prohibit, and prosecute the rise of the illegal tissue, fetal tissue market in Minnesota? Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Ray Parker and then Sue Abderholden, please come down. Please go ahead.
My name is Ray Parker from Rochester, and I'm here in disagreement of any money allotted to HF 91. This is the most egregious bill you've come up with, and are you trying to bankrupt Minnesota by funding all abortions and transgender surgeries and treatments for any state? Planned Parenthood was government funded in 2022 with $553.7 million. Health and Human Services disbursed $265 million in Title X grants, including $16 million to Planned Parenthood regional groups. Jeff Bezos' wife gave $275 million to Planned Parenthood herself. Do they really need more funding? And let me raise the question of litigation and the possible millions that will be spent on that alone. You are moving the safety nets to assure safe procedures. The through-the-mail abortion pills, not the morning-after pill, is only approved for pregnancies up to 10 weeks. Just three more weeks of gestation, that would be 13 weeks, increases the risks of excessive bleeding and the need for surgical intervention that rises to 33%. Without in-person exams, no one can know how far the pregnancy has progressed or if, in fact, it's an ectopic pregnancy for which that pill would not be safe. Subverting other states' laws is also problematic legally. Why do you want to expose our state to lawsuits with these horrendous bills you are turning into law? Since we cannot appeal to your humanity, can we appeal to your greed? Many children who have been convinced they're misgendered are regretting having their bodies mutilated. Could lead to quite a lot of litigation.
You. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
So next is Sue Abderholden, followed by Dr. Jess Meehy, and then Justin Stoffron. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Sue Abderholden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, and we appreciate you trying to address the new mental health crisis, which is seen by increased boarding and increased suicides. And you're doing this by building our crisis system, implementing 988 and increasing funding for our crisis teams, building our children's mental health system by funding the Third Path, Transition to Community Initiative, First Psychotic Episode Programs, and School Linked, addressing disparities by funding CMIG, supporting adults with mental illnesses through increased funding for the HASAMI housing grants, helping people navigate the system by funding an online portal, and addressing the workforce crisis by funding the mental health supervision grant. We appreciate these investments and policy changes. If possible, we hope that in the future, perhaps we could look at funding voluntary engagement, adding a little money to the respite care grants and early childhood mental health, and supporting BIPOC mental health professionals to become supervisors. We know that it wasn't easy to develop this bill with all the increased and unmet needs in so many areas of healthcare and human services. We do appreciate these investments and policy changes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. And the next person is Justin Stoffron, followed by Geraldine Hausback. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and the committee members, for the opportunity to support House Floor 2930. My name is Dr. Jessica Meehy, and I am the founder and clinic director of a school-based health center in White Bear Lake. I'm also a faculty member at St. Catherine University and a board member of the Minnesota School-Based Health Alliance. And I'm thrilled to share with you the successes of Minnesota's 29 school-based health centers as they work to improve health and educational outcomes in the state. Positioned strategically where children spend most of their weekday hours, school-based health centers interrupt social structural barriers because of their unique location and in turn improve accessibility to care. Compared to other private or community clinics, school-based health centers consistently demonstrate improved health outcomes in children, regardless of their insurance status, their race, or ethnicity. Children who use school-based health centers have increased preventative rates, are more likely to use mental health counseling, and have decreased hospitalizations and emergency department visits. Students also demonstrate increased academic performance through more in-class time, higher GPAs, and increased graduation rates. These clinics also have an economic impact. There are net savings to taxpayers and state Medicaid programs, and thousands of dollars in savings for families. There continues to be a growing need for these clinics as we enter the pandemic recovery phase. Students are incredibly behind on their immunizations and preventative care, leading to concerns about communicable diseases across the state. At the Bear Care Clinic in White Bear Lake, we are on track to see over 2,000 students this school year. This bill will allow school-based health centers to remain sustainable and expand across the state, and to continue for us to be a key partner with the state. Thank you for your support, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome to the committee. And next is Geraldine Houseback.
Chair Liebling and committee members, my name is Justin Stopron with the Minnesota Farmers Union, which is a grassroots organization representing family farmers, ranchers, and rural communities in Minnesota. I appreciate the opportunity to testify today on two key priorities of ours that are in this bill. We've also submitted a letter to the committee on several other provisions in the legislation. Increasing access to affordable health care was the top priority our members identified for this coming year. As small business owners, family farmers disproportionately purchase health insurance on the individual market and are hit hard by high premiums and a lack of choice between health plans in rural areas. This is why MFU strongly supports the inclusion in this legislation of provisions from House File 96, Representative Long's proposal to create a Minnesota Care public option, which is one of MFU's top priorities this legislative session. I do want to note, while we support the public option in this bill, we do hope the committee will consider inclusion of a small employer public option, which was a component of Representative Long's original proposal. Finally, another driver of high health care costs, as this committee has discussed in previous hearings, is consolidation and mergers, which is why we really appreciate the Representative Bierman's House File 402, which will create greater oversight of hospital mergers, is also included in this bill. I want to thank Representative Bierman, Representative Long, and of course you, Chair Liebling, for the inclusion of these important provisions in this legislation. Reducing the cost of health care for farmers and Minnesotans across the state is key to ensuring greater economic opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Geraldine Houseback is next, and then on deck is Betty Emarita. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It's my pleasure to be here today. My name is Geraldine Houseback. I am the executive director at My Health for Teens and Young Adults, formerly West Suburban Teen Clinic. My Health is a standalone nonprofit clinic that has been providing reproductive health care to young people ages 12 to 26 since 1972. Each year we serve more than 1,000 people in our clinic, and additionally we provide community outreach and education to nearly 18,000 young people, adults working with youth, and parents. I am also the treasurer of the Reproductive Health Alliance. The Reproductive Health Alliance is a statewide coalition of organizations, individual providers, and advocates focused on providing high quality, culturally competent, and accessible reproductive health services to individuals in need across this state. On behalf of My Health for Teens, the Reproductive Health Alliance Coalition, and the more than 30 organizations currently receiving family planning special projects funding, we thank you for including the increase of nearly $7 million in this budget for this grant. As you know, funding for family planning programs like this saves significant tax dollars by reducing teen and unplanned pregnancies, reduces the incidence and impact of preterm births, reduces STIs and HIV, reduces infertility, and reduces cervical cancer. While I cannot speak for all of the Family Planning Special Project recipients, I can tell you that this funding is vital to keeping the doors open at My Health. It has been incredibly difficult to maintain competitive wages, recruit and retain licensed medical staff, increase our programming, and expand our reach due to funding limitations. Again, I thank you for ensuring that reproductive health clinics across the state will continue to provide pre-pregnancy and reproductive health care to low-income, high-risk Minnesotans. Okay.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck will be Megan Walsh. Welcome to the committee. Please go ahead and give us your name and go ahead.
Chair Liebling and members of the House Health Committee. I'm Betty Amarita, a member of the Start Early's Funders, a collaboration of funders that support early childhood statewide. I also co-chair the Advisory Council of the Minnesota Community Solutions for Healthy Child Development Grant Program. I've lived and raised children both in a rural county where everybody is related by blood, marriage, or history, with all the joy and trouble that implies, and in a city where the trade-offs between time, money, and sanity get more serious every year. In both places, community is everything. When communities are healthy and thriving, the children in those communities reflect that reality. When communities are stressed and struggling, that's also reflected. The Community Solutions Grant Program does two things. One, we fund community-generated solutions for problems that are defined by the community. Two, we work with the Bureau of Health Equity and the Department of Health to share our learnings and observations so they are able to serve these communities more effectively. The Community Solutions Grant Program makes space for people to develop and implement practical solutions at the community level. Through our learnings and recommendations, we help the Bureau to refine their processes for administering grants and contracts and ensure accountability without unintentionally undermining the effectiveness of community-based strategies. This grant program continues the leadership role Minnesota has played in other innovations that support communities and expand people's choices, like early education scholarships, charter schools, community-supported agriculture and food co-ops. Minnesota has always stood up for local solutions. This program continues.
I have to ask you to wrap up, please.
This program continues that tradition. It leverages community knowledge. I urge you to robustly support the Community Solutions Fund for Healthy Child Development Grant Program and to give this program the permanent funding needed to fully deliver on its promise.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck will be Terry Wilder, and now we have Dr. Walsh. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, Ranking Member Schumacher, and members of the committee. I am Dr. Megan Walsh, the Chief Academic and Research Officer for Hennepin Healthcare and a member of the Metro Minnesota Council on Graduate Medical Education, the MMCGME. We are a collaboration of the major teaching hospitals in the metro, including Hennepin Healthcare, Health Partners, MHealth Fairview, the University of Minnesota, the Minneapolis VA, Allina, and Children's Hospital. Collectively, our members provide over 60% of the physician residency and advanced practice professional training in Minnesota. For nearly 30 years, the Medical Education and Research Cost Program, or MERC, has allowed our systems to continue to train these essential workers. The state support for MERC has been vital. It has allowed us to train the workforce needed in Minnesota, direct costs that are not otherwise covered by federal GME support, including the training salaries for primary care and mental health providers, as well as training in clinics throughout greater Minnesota, the county jails, and federally qualified health centers, where rotations might otherwise mean zero reimbursement. Without MERC funding, research and training programs is threatened. Our teaching hospitals rapidly flexed to new therapies and added capacity during the COVID pandemic. Without MERC, this just isn't possible. Thank you to Governor Walz and Chair Liebling for including this initiative in both proposals. This is not a new appropriation, but merely represents restoration of permanent state funds that existed prior to November's budget forecast. We respectfully request the study group language be amended to allow stakeholders to work with DHS and MDH to seek new options to maximize federal funding for healthcare education. Thank you for the new investments in expanding primary care through MDH. And because of this, Hennepin alone has added 14 additional primary care doctors and psychiatrists to community clinics in places like Austin, Minnesota, and Red Wing. The budget proposed by this committee ensures that Minnesota continues to invest in the healthcare workforce into the future and expand opportunities to train our future physicians, advanced practice providers, and healthcare professionals. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck will be Travis Buccello, and this would be Terry Wilder. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is Terry Wilder. I'm the chair of In the Action Minnesota, which is a statewide organization fighting for health equity for people with myalgic encephalomyelitis and long COVID. First, I want to acknowledge that many people with long COVID are unable to travel here today to share their experiences due to how disabling this disease is. I know firsthand the impact of having a disease that's underfunded and under-researched, as I have myalgic encephalomyelitis. It can destroy your dreams and quality of life, and I'm determined to prevent others from experiencing the same. It's estimated that 10 to 20% of all Minnesotans who got COVID have experienced long COVID symptoms. This suggests that there are potentially hundreds of thousands of Minnesotans with long COVID who are experiencing significant impacts to their health, functionality, and quality of life. And that includes children, adolescents, and young adults. It's also estimated that around 50% of people with long COVID meet the clinical criteria for the disease I have, myalgic encephalomyelitis. And this is a disabling and complex disease that impacts multiple body systems. It's a neurological disease, according to the World Health Organization. I also want to highlight that COVID-19 has disproportionately impacted Black, Indigenous, and other non-white communities, as well as low-income, rural, disabled, and elder populations. Federal efforts around long COVID have been slow and do not provide the needed resources to establish action and infrastructure at the state and community level, and that's why the long COVID funding proposed in the governor's budget is critical. Supporting this funding is the right thing to do. It's critical that these dollars be made available to support and expand the Minnesota Department of Health's work around long COVID. Thank you again for your attention to this matter. We have the opportunity to make a real difference in the lives of Minnesotans with long COVID and set an example for states across the country. I urge you and your colleagues to support this funding. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck will be Mike Opat and Travis Buccello. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Travis Buccello, and I'm here on behalf of the Healthcare Distribution Alliance, the National Trade Association representing healthcare wholesale distributors. Each day, wholesale distributors work around the clock to ship roughly 15 million medical products and medicines to nearly 180,000 points of care across the country, including hospitals, clinics, and pharmacies. Their core business is not manufacturing, nor do they prescribe medicines, influence healthcare professionals' prescribing patterns, or set the wholesale acquisition costs of medications. While we support the state's efforts in seeking a better understanding of the price of prescription drugs, however, the information our members are required to report in HF 2930 will be unduly burdensome to our industry and have a disparate impact on business operations. HDA respectfully requests the committee consider limiting to the reporting in the bill to the top 25 costliest drugs as determined by the department, as well as consider additional technical amendments to the bill that would help create more uniformity across our reporting standards. In order to accurately reflect the role of distributors and the role that we play within the supply chain, we respectfully ask the committee to adopt these amendments, and we sincerely welcome the opportunity to work with the committee as well as the department in implementing these provisions. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony, and please be sure to submit that to us. Next on deck will be Bethlehem Uwalawirk and Mike Opat. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair. My name is Mike Opat. I'm the Chief Business Development and Community Relations Officer at North Memorial Health. I'm here to oppose Article 2 of the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act, now contained in Sections 82, 87 through 94, 192, and 202. We support other aspects of the bill. But Article 2 contains prescriptive language that goes beyond what was collectively bargained and agreed to by the MNA and North Memorial. This is the North Memorial contract with the MNA. It's more than 120 pages. 10 of those pages are devoted to staffing and processes and committees that are set forth to appropriately agree to staffing and arrive at it. This contract was agreed to by the parties. It does not include mandatory arbitration as does as is contained in the omnibus bill. We request that the committee remove Article 2 and respect the work of those who collectively bargained in good faith over months to come to this agreement. We request that you not legislate conflict at a time when we need to work together more than ever. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Natasha Chernyavsky will be on deck. And so let's see, did we have Bethlehem Uwalawirk? Okay, I think that person might not be here. Okay. So Natasha Cherniavsky and then Anna Odegaard on deck. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Natasha Cherniavsky. I'm with Citizens Council for Health Freedom. And I'm here today to share several concerns that we see with this bill, specifically data collection and use provisions that have not received a hearing in judiciary. We believe the civil rights implications in this bill have not been properly reviewed or discussed. However, before I get to my concerns, I do want to just point out that we really appreciate Representative Richardson's bill being included in Article 3, Section 81. Our only suggestion to this is that you would expand that right to have a support person to all patients so that no one would be hospitalized without access to their loved ones or to a support person. But regarding our concerns, starting off with Article 3, Section 86, there are changes made to the Cancer Surveillance Program, which will result with cancer patients further losing their right to privacy and consent. Next, Article 3, Section 193 creates a long COVID surveillance and research program that hasn't been evaluated by the Judiciary Committee. Trusted professionals should not be required to share the data on their patients without their consent to the state government. We are also concerned with the numerous references to social determinants of health, a term that as of yet has not been defined in Minnesota law, which begs the question, what exactly will be being collected? What are these data points? Article 3, Sections 28 through 33 amends the all-payer claims database to add value over volume determinations. Using third-party definitions for value of care will enable unethical outside influence on private decisions made between patients and doctors. Additionally, the overdose and morbidity section requires systematic collection of data without patient or parent consent. And then my last concern is not related to data, but rather related to the $5 million appropriated to the study of a cost and benefits analysis of a universal healthcare system. And we would just say that a government-led, government-run healthcare system is not the solution to Minnesota's healthcare problems. And so therefore, ask for opposition to this bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. And it was just noted to me that some folks who are signed up to testify may, in fact, be in the overflow room. And if that is the case, just come on up when you hear your name and we'll squeeze you in. So we don't want anyone to miss their opportunity because they're in the overflow room. So after Anna Odegaard will be Bentley Graves. Ms. Odegaard, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair Liebling. My name is Anna Odegaard. I'm the director of the Minnesota Asset Building Coalition, and I'd like to thank Chair Liebling and this committee for the investments you make in this bill for a healthier Minnesota, and especially for the provisions in this bill that focus on access to care as a critical component of health equity. In particular, I'd like to thank the chair and Representative Ryer for their leadership on the Get Covered bill, which requires hospitals to screen patients for eligibility for public health care programs and hospital financial assistance prior to taking action to collect medical debt through collections, garnishment, or other legal action against the patient or denial of care. I don't need to explain to this committee how devastating medical debt can be for families already living paycheck to paycheck. The Get Covered bill sets a uniform standard for steps hospitals must take prior to taking steps to collect medical debt to ensure that patients are able to access the coverage for the assistance they qualify and have assistance with the application. This is a straightforward approach to supporting Minnesotans' access to health care and recognizing the intersection of financial stability with overall health and well-being. Thank you so much for supporting this common sense measure.
Thank you for your testimony. So next is Bentley Graves, followed by Dave Renner on deck. So if you could both come down. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce, and I will note that as I mentioned before, we have members in every corner of the state, every industry in the state, including many health industry members who I think I can safely say occupy positions on virtually every issue contained in this bill. But I'm here today representing our 6,000 employer members and their 500,000 employees. I want to start by just quickly reiterating our concerns with public option, the buy-in, and the nurse staffing provisions included in as part of the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act that would include rigid mandated processes for nurse staffing. You know, we've shared those concerns with the committee and I won't belabor those here today. I also want to note, we do have some concern with the significant draw from the Healthcare Access Fund at a time when the state is enjoying an $18 billion surplus. And this draw, this billion-dollar draw, comes at a time when this bill sets up significant amounts of transition and perhaps challenges in our healthcare ecosystem you know, could be helped along by resources, an abundance of resources in the Healthcare Access Fund. So we would urge caution in removing those funds at this time with so much on the horizon coming as part of this bill. As it relates to the Healthcare Affordability Commission, we would urge the committee members to take a look at a bill that Representative Schumacher has, House File 1085. First and foremost, that sets up a similar type of commission, but there's a heavy influence on it being independent of appointments from the legislature, independent appointments from the governor. We think that's a very important aspect of something like that that would go a ways in helping ensure the success of the body. And also, we would urge it be started as a recommending body, similar to what MedPAC does at the federal level. Appreciate the inclusion of the pieces related to the APCD, and continue to have concerns about the mandates included in the bill, but appreciate the time to testify today, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Graves. So on deck will be Julianne Zulke and Mr. Renner. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members, Dave Renner. I represent the Minnesota Medical Association. I also speak to the Minnesota Academy of Family Physicians. We have a letter in the packet as well, which articulates a number of issues that we support. I want to highlight just five priorities. And thank you for putting in the continued coverage for telehealth and audio-only coverage, which we think is critical to maintain. Also, thank you for continuing the including the coverage for recuperative care services to address homeless and those with housing insecurity. The updated language on the all-payer claim database, which we think is critical to ensure that we're gathering the correct data on how much we're spending on health care. Also, the addressing workforce shortage, specifically the rural and primary care training grants for both residency and medical students and others. And then also the inclusion of the funding for the PULSE program, which is a priority. I also want to highlight just two concerns that we continue to work with the authors. One is, while we support some of the pieces related to the healthcare affordability, we have some concerns about the makeup and the authority there, and we want to continue to discuss. And similarly, on the Representative Bierman's bill with the authority on mergers, we have had a number of conversations. We continue to have conversations. We support the concerns about over-consolidation, and we look forward to continuing to work with Representative Bierman to address some of the concerns we have there. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. So on deck will be Mary Beth Olson. And welcome to the committee. Please state your name and go ahead.
I'm Julianne Zulke. I'm a living, breathing woman born on the soil in this great state with the status of an American Minnesota state national. I do not consent to the passage of House File 91 and the repealer section 15 in particular, which removes safeguards related to the reproductive industry and turns Minnesota into the wild, wild west. The word salad the House File 91 has makes my mind spin. It exposes the administrative state and the fictional corporate non-constitutional state government operating under the color of law and playing God. I have three notable points to share. Notably, number one, House File 91 violates the constitutional 1776 Declaration of Independence, which asserts that the government established by and for we the people must protect our God-given right to life. Notably, number two, House File 91 falls under the 1803 Supreme Court decision, Marbury versus Madison, which reads that all laws in violation of the Constitution are null and void. Notably, number three, House File 91 represents a high degree of legislative tomfoolery and possible misprision, which is knowing what is right and not doing it. As one of we the people, and I repeat, I do not consent, I encourage you to not violate your oath to uphold our Constitution, and I encourage you to protect life and vote down House File 91. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck is Adam Carlin. And Mary Beth Olson, welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Mary Beth Olson. I'm the Vice President of Acute Care Nursing Operations at Allina Health. And my responsibilities include developing strategies to address the acute care RN workforce. I have over 39 years of experience working as a nurse, and the nurse staffing committee provisions in this bill would compromise access to the quality of care and would ultimately lead to hospital units being closed and patients backing up in our emergency rooms, further delaying care. We deeply value and respect the critical role that nursing professionals play in delivering high-quality care to our patients. This bill calls for arbitration if the committee can't agree to the staffing ratio. Arbitrators are not staffing experts. The current challenge is not our unwillingness to hire nurses, as evidenced by the number of current open RN positions across the state. It is a lack of available workforce. In our most recent contract negotiations with M&A, we agreed to an additional format, additional formal process to bring concerns forward in real time, as well as a process for escalation in real time if the nurse is not satisfied with the response from their charge nurse. This escalation process supports the nurse in further problem solving with on-site leadership real time. We are working continuously as an organization to recruit and retain our nursing professionals. They are integral members of our care teams, and we are committed to providing our nurses with the support and resources they need to thrive in their careers. Our transparent and efficient process for dealing with concern for safe staffing is one way we are providing that support. Other retention efforts include compensation that is among the highest in the nation, flexible scheduling to support balanced lives with the majority of our hospital RNs now working part-time, as well as efforts to improve the safety of our care teams. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And on deck is Mary Krinke and Adam Carlin. Welcome.
Madam Chair, my name is Adam Carlin, and I'm the Nursing Director for Critical Care at Methodist Hospital. One of my concerns with the nurse staffing mandate in this bill is the impact it will have on health equity across our state. Minnesotans seeking care in our busy emergency departments and critical access hospitals, some of our most vulnerable and underserved citizens, stand to lose the most under this legislation. For example, the requirement to post emergency department wait times could be extremely misleading to the public. We triage ER patients according to acuity, and I'm scared to think that someone in need of emergency care for a heart attack, stroke, or pregnancy-induced high blood pressure may stay home due to a wait time that does not apply to their critical condition. This bill suggests that elective procedures should be given less priority for a hospital bed than any unplanned admission or sudden change in staffing. In my hospital, elective procedures include patients undergoing open heart surgery and cancer surgery. This bill authorizes any hospital nurse to unilaterally refuse, with impunity, to accept a patient, effectively confining our most vulnerable patients, including those experiencing mental health emergencies, to our busy emergency departments. While unintended, this bill creates significant opportunity for individual bias to determine who receives care in our hospitals. I believe that our nurses care deeply about our patients, and fortunately for all of us, so do their hospital leaders, many of whom are nurses. Yet the longstanding false narrative that hospital leaders are only concerned with the bottom line is perpetuated in this bill, and it undermines collaboration needed to provide excellent care. Before you enact such burdensome language around committee and racial mandates of this bill, I am asking you, have you done a comprehensive assessment of the hospital staffing data that is already submitted quarterly and is publicly available? This bill would be seriously detrimental to patient care in Minnesota. A decision this big should be led by data that exists, combined with the expertise of hospital leaders and frontline care teams, including our nurses, not by a legislative mandate. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck will be Angela Fields and Mary Krinke. Welcome.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. There are certainly good provisions in this bill: healthcare workforce investments, MRC funding, telehealth funding, and continuous eligibility for low-income children in our medical assistance program. Unfortunately, this bill contains many provisions that are bad for hospitals and health systems and the patients that we serve. Number one, MHA is disappointed that the small financial request that hospitals were seeking this year to update the fee-for-service inpatient medical assistance rates to provide an additional inflationary increase was not included in the bill. The median operating margin right now is -1.5%, and a frightening 56% of our Minnesota hospitals now have a negative operating margin. With 61% of our patients on a government health care program, we need the state to pay closer attention and pay closer to the actual costs of providing care. While this is an unintended consequence of carving out the outpatient prescription drug benefit from the PMAP program and moving it back into fee-for-service, it will nonetheless be an estimated $70 million to $80 million annual cut to hospitals participating in the 340B drug program, purchasing program. Number three, the Minnesota Care buy-in option promises to be an affordable insurance option, but that's because it's based on lower provider payments. Right now, the average commercial payers are paying hospitals about twice as much as medical assistance and Minnesota Care payments. Minnesota Care eligibility can be expanded to go up to 300% or 400% of the federal poverty guidelines, but it needs to have an income cap. We ask legislators to think about the impact of some of these provisions. Hospitals are currently in a weak financial position, and we need your help. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So after Angela Fields, we will have Jay McLaren on deck, and welcome to the committee.
Hello, my name is Angela Fields, and I'm a community health worker and also an associate executive director of the Minnesota CHW Community Health Worker Alliance of Bloomington, Minnesota. Thank you, Madam Chair, and the members of this committee for hearing my testimony and attention to this issue. With 15 years of service, I have countless stories to illustrate the importance of CHW's impact going beyond clinical walls and organizational walls. CHWs find the key to unlock effective and efficient care and resources for those we serve. In 2016, an elderly man was cycling in and out of the ER. He was treated and discharged only to return to the ER days later for the same treatment. The patient cycled in a total of 4 visits in 2 weeks. The ER staff assigned him a CHW to his care plan. The CHW completed the home visit and assessment, and the patient then found the patient was suffering from heat-related conditions. It was summertime, and the temperatures in his house rose to unsafe levels. Because of the CHW reporting, a social worker was added to his care plan. The CHW aligned with the social worker and helped navigate resources that provided an AC unit for his home. As a result, the patient received the AC unit, and this stopped the costly ER visits. Research showed that the net return on investment of the use of a CHW is 3-to-1 ratio. For every dollar spent on a CHW service, health care saves $3. We work with communities to prevent unnecessary ER visits, hospitalizations, and readmissions. We avert preventable nursing home admissions. We connect people to affordable health care. We help people navigate the health and social system. These stories like this strengthen and sustain the Minnesota CHW workforce is in need of your help to close the Minnesota costly gaps in health equity. Thank you for your consideration in extending access to CHW services by supporting this vital funding and adding CHWs back to the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. After Mr. McLaren is Ryan Kelly. Mr. McLaren, welcome.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Jay McLaren, and I'm the Vice President of Public Policy and Government Relations at Medica. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. I want to highlight a couple of things that our organization supports. There are many in the bill, but two I'd like to highlight are the significant investment in the mental health infrastructure in this state. Echo the comments that were made earlier by NAMI. Second thing is continuous enrollment for new moms and babies. We think this is an incredibly important public policy goal and achievement in the state in order to improve the health of those individuals. At the same time, we have policy concerns and questions on the financial estimates for the managed care opt-out that I want to highlight for the committee. So in reviewing the fiscal note for the underlying bill, it appears that the fiscal note takes into account the 8% managed care withhold in that estimate. However, there are three things that it appears it does not take into account that we have significant concerns over. One is the accounting shift applied to managed care, which happens at the end of every fiscal biennium. Second is the loss of tax revenue from the 1% HMO tax and 0.6% HMO surcharge. Does not appear to be in the estimate. And third are cost savings attached to items that managed care organizations are held financially responsible for, including lowering hospital emergency department use, lowering hospital admissions, and lowering hospital readmissions. These are performance withholds that we're required to execute on as a term of our contract with the department. And if people are no longer in those contracts and with the Department of Human Services through fee-for-service, utilization will go up. So we're concerned about that for the opt-out, and if these are not included in the estimate of getting rid of managed care, we have concerns about that as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. On deck is Marco Alvarez, and next is Ryan Kelly. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. My name is Ryan Kelly. I am a physician at the University of Minnesota. I practice at the Community University Healthcare Center, a FQHC in Minneapolis. I'm the director of the Addiction Medicine Consult Team at the University of Minnesota Medical Center, and I am chair of the Minnesota Medical Association's Subcommittee on Harm Reduction and Decriminalization. Every day I serve people who are struggling with substance use disorders, people who don't have access to housing, people who don't have the luxury to focus on their health care, people who don't have the resources to make a scheduled appointment, something that many of us take for granted. You know, without access to safe use supplies, overdose prevention hubs, and harm reduction methods that decrease infections, decrease overdoses, and lead to building relationships that can increase access down the road, my patients are actively dying from overdoses. They're actively contracting HIV, hepatitis C, and they're actively being admitted to hospitals with severe complications of bacterial infections. These not only are devastating their lives, but this is leading to drastic increases in healthcare costs. The Minnesota Medical Association, the Minnesota chapter of the American College of Physicians, and myself strongly support provisions in HF 2930 that cover substance use and opioid treatment, prevention, and rehab as covered in Article 3, Section 39, page 119, Article 12, Sections 5, 6, and 7, pages 470, 474, 476. Finally, we support Section 114, which is the repealer of 152.092. You know, the new Minnesota Medical Association policy supports, you know, decriminalizing possession of illicit drugs for personal use as well as paraphernalia. You know, any penalties for possession of illicit drugs for personal use fail to deter use, causes farther harm to people who use drugs, leads to penalties that deter people from seeking safe use supplies and seeking help, and devastate lives. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck is going to be Maggie Hange and Marco Loera Alvarez. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Liebling, committee members, my name is Marco Loera Alvarez, and I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. I am a pharmacy technician, and I'm a leader with Unidos. Today, I'm here to share my family's struggle with healthcare. In 2004, my father was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes and thyroid disease. My dad was lucky to have been granted health care insurance to the state, which helped tremendously for his medicine and appointments. Fast forward to 2006, after policy changes, my dad was no longer able to qualify for insurance. We, and I mean we, because we all suffered as a family. There was times where my dad's diabetes would reach levels above 300, and we were scared to go to the ER because of the hefty price tag. Mentally, we were depleted, scared, exhausted of having to navigate such a complicated system. If we want kids to be successful, we must think of the parents. You want kids, you want healthy kids, give them healthy parents. You want, our immigration status should not determine whether we have dignified health care for our hardworking parents, our uncles, aunts, friends, and family. Let's not forget whose bodies were on the line during COVID, yet through all of this, essential workers don't have accessible health care and are still dealing with secondary effects from contracting COVID. It's time to show up for our hardworking immigrants and grant them access to health care. Please continue fighting for the Minnesota Immigrant Inclusion Act until it becomes law. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Maggie Hange, and then Dan Murphy is on deck afterwards. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Maggie Hange, Policy Associate for the Minnesota Catholic Conference, the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota. I'm here today to share opposition to multiple sections within HF 2930, particularly relating to abortion. If this bill were to pass, it would force even more tax dollars from hardworking Minnesotans to be used to fund elective abortions in our state. The Minnesota Catholic bishops have consistently supported health care reform derived from our core values. But health care should never be used to take or destroy life. It is an insult for the public funds to be used in this way. Over the course of 10 years, Minnesota paid nearly $24 million in abortion reimbursements, and that was only through one funding stream. There are many more. Unfortunately, with this significant change, Minnesota care and medical assistance will no longer respect the dignity of every human person, including preborn children. And this change will prohibit our church, which helped craft Minnesota care, from supporting the program going forward, including inhibiting our ability to support Minnesota care coverage for the undocumented, on which we have been strong advocates. This bill also threatens to remove the abortion reporting requirement. These reports are filled with valuable data from which all Minnesotans benefit. The information they contain can help our society and government address the economic and racial disparities that impact pregnant Minnesotans. Not everyone who obtains an abortion truly wants to do so. If a mother desires to carry her baby to term, it is our duty as a community to support and guide her. We can do this best when we know the difficulties she faces in the decision-making process. HF 2930 seeks to repeal many more provisions relating to abortion. Is this the society we want to create here in Minnesota? Do we truly want to expand taxpayer funding of abortion and remove nearly all common health safety protections? It seems instead of trying to help women, we are bowing to big abortion and working to create a world in which they rule and we follow. Please oppose these provisions. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So Dan Murphy, followed by Edward Krumpotich.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dan Murphy, and I am the Governor of Affairs Manager for the Minnesota Dental Association. I'll direct you to our written testimony in support of various dental-related positions, most notably the restoration of the adult dental Medicaid benefits that carried by Vice Chairman Berman. Today, I want to call attention to two areas of concern for our organization. First, language included in Article 3, Section 47 adds language pertaining to the dentist seat on the Rural Health Advisory Committee. The MDA believes the dentist seat should remain as a standalone position and supports the addition of an allied dental professional. This has already been done in the Senate, and the MDA supports this committee doing so as well. Second, the MDA notes that the language pertaining to dental rate rebasing was not included in this bill. This legislation was heard in this committee and laid over on February 28th and was also heard just last week in the government budget proposal hearing. A 2021 study by the American Dental Association ranked Minnesota at 47 out of 50 states for adult dental reimbursement and 49 for pediatric dental reimbursement. Despite a historic 98% rate increase in 2021, the bait race for reimbursement is still set on costs set in 1989. Further, the Department of Human Services issued a report last year stating that the top reason for dental provider hesitancy to participate in medical assistant and Minnesota care was low reimbursement. Given the budget surplus, various challenges associated with provider participation in state programs, and overall access to care issues, the MDA believes that now is the right time to rebase dental rates on an ongoing basis. Madam Chair, members, I respectfully ask that you can reconsider and include rebasing in your final bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And then on deck is Kathy Blazer. And then welcome to the committee. Please pronounce your name for me. I'm sorry.
Absolutely. My name is Edward Krumpotich. I'm a drug policy advocate consultant for the Drug Policy Alliance. I'm also a drug policy advocate consultant for the National Harm Reduction Coalition, the chair of the Minnesota Harm Reduction Collaborative, and the chair of the Human Rights Commission here in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, and proud to be. Minnesota is in the midst of an overdose crisis. Since 2010, there have been 327% increase in opioid-related deaths, HIV outbreaks in Hennepin, Ramsey, and St. Louis counties, as well as steady increases in hepatitis C cases, confirm that our state has the wrong approach to our drug epidemic. Minnesota's lock 'em up first mentality has resulted in a 370% increase in our jails population since 1970. 370%. Our cancerous attitudes towards substance use disorder and people who use substances has resulted in further incarceration, marginalization, and death in disproportionately affected communities. Our communities of color, indigenous communities, LGBTQIA+, urban and rural Minnesotans like my Grand Rapids residents deserve better. HF 2041 provides legal protections for our harm reduction and health workers. It expands drug testing to allow for more than just fentanyl test strips, including xylazine test strips and others, and allows pharmacists the discretion to provide syringes at any number for their local communities. Did you know that if you visit a syringe service provider, you are 5 times more likely to enter drug treatment? You are 50% likely to reduce infectious diseases like HIV and hepatitis C. These are common sense solutions. Abstinence lives here. Use lives here. Harm reduction lives right here. It is the spectrum between use and abstinence, and we are getting this wrong. Let the harm reduction experts, the substance use experts, the doctors, and those people who are on the ground, who, by the way, are currently criminalized, people who own syringe service programs are criminalized for dispensing those needed supplies. Please listen to us when writing this legislation, and thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck will be Ryan Gilbertson, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Kathy Blazer, co-executive director of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. If Minnesota is to be a just society, we must defend our most innocent, our most defenseless citizens. This bill does just the opposite. The bill has provisions that take more of our taxpayer dollars to pay for more abortions. At the same time, it would eliminate funds that currently go to pregnancy resource centers that provide material, educational, and many other types of support for babies, their mothers, and their fathers. The bill eliminates most of the Born Alive Infant Protection Act in a way that actually threatens all newborns, not just those who survive an abortion.
It eliminates our current law's requirement for medical care to protect the life and health of any born alive baby, regardless of the circumstances of that birth, reducing the requirement to simply care, a much lower standard than these babies deserve. One could hope for at least comfort care, but even that is not a promise in this language. And as this legislature moves to increase the number of abortions performed here, this bill eliminates the recording of any abortion statistics, information which helps protect women by shining a light on complication and morbidity rates from procedures that threaten their future reproductive health and their lives. Finally, this bill threatens the lives of our disabled, chronically ill, and vulnerable elderly patients with its Health Care Affordability Commission, which will have the power to force private health entities to slow their spending in order to meet government-mandated targets. In practice, as medical entities are forced by the state to reduce spending, those cuts will inevitably affect the direct patient care of our most vulnerable and more expensive patients. This bill threatens Minnesotans' lives from beginning to end. Minnesotans expect and deserve better from our legislature. Please vote no. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Dan Andreessen is on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Ryan Gilbertson, and I'm part of a loose coalition of groups working to address the impacts of labor trafficking. That coalition includes the City of Minneapolis, Hennepin County, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, Advocates for Human Rights, Restoration for All, the Ennington Story, the International Institute of Minnesota, the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, The Link, Southwest Minnesota Crisis Center, the Teamsters Joint Council 32, the Minnesota Building and Constructions Trade Council, and the Laborers International Union of North America. I'm testifying today in support of this bill and to say thank you for including funds to support victims of labor trafficking. This funding will help ensure continuity of services for victims in Minnesota, a critical component of our state's response to trafficking more broadly. Having the Minnesota Department of Health administer the grant program ensures we are solving public health problems with public health solutions. Specifically, these dollars will fund emergency housing, case management, and legal services for those who have been exploited. This significant investment will provide significant value. Currently, there are no dedicated state funds to address these issues. Additionally, we will see more victims who need help as we look to expand our efforts to hold traffickers accountable through legislation like HF 42, which the House unanimously supported. Thank you again for your support of this work and for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck will be Reuben Moore and Mr. Andreessen, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Andreessen with the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. We do have a letter in your packet. First, starting with items that we do support, the inclusion of MA cessation coverage, expanding the MA dental benefit and the Critical Access Dental Infrastructure Grant Program, healthcare workforce grants, expansion of Minnesota care to undocumented residents, continuous MA coverage of children, and the systems modernization and IT upgrades for the department. A couple items for consideration is there's several benefit mandates in the bill that go into effect in 2024. We would request that those be moved to 2025 to match up when health plans write their plans. Right now, we're finishing our 2024 plans. And so would request that those implementation dates be moved to 2025. We renew our request to add some language into the Minnesota Care Buy-In Study so that we're studying more than just the buy-in but other alternatives. Regarding the prescription drug carve-out language, testimony on this bill mentioned that it was needed to help small independent pharmacies. We say that if that is the goal, then the legislature just needs to raise dispensing rates. That's in Article 2, Section 13. Completely carving out the drug benefits will have significant impacts to MA enrollees, and respectfully, it's a proverbial using of an axe to win a scalpel will do. We do want to point out a couple of interactions that the provisions will have with one another. There is language in the bill that we do oppose moving the managed care program into fee-for-service and the small CBPs. This is also includes for the Minnesota Care program. If you're going to also be expanding that program for a buy-in program, just keep in mind that those two are interacting with one another. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck will be Julie Sordahl and Reuben Moore. Welcome.
Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Ruben Moore. I'm the Executive Officer of Minnesota Community Care, serving 35,000 Minnesotans here in the East Metro as one of 17 FQHCs serving 300,000 Minnesotans. I want to thank you both. Thank you all in this body for HF 2930. Many of the provisions in the bill benefit communities served by FQHCs. A letter in your packet from the Minnesota Association of Community Health Centers outlined the bill's impact, positive impact on access for FQHC patients. I want to briefly touch on the provisions in Article 2, Section 10, which amends HF 693. The bill previously includes payments to FQHCs to support and expand FQHC care coordination, patient outreach, eligibility assistance services. This provision now creates an implementation plan and would consider these payments as part of care coordination models and impact of 340B. FQHCs are in a tough environment right now with profound stress, unburdened stress of the healthcare ecosystem on our frontline workers. FQHCs would like to get additional funding for our immediate needs. Please consider the original provisions expanding robust care coordination, patient outreach, eligibility assistance for FQHCs, and a pilot as part of this transition phase. A funded pilot can demonstrate these services' impact on some of the state's most vulnerable populations. These payments will help us build health equity by addressing social drivers of health. I'll be happy to discuss this further with the body of this committee, and thank you.
Thank you. On deck will be Tom Lehman. Next is Julie Sordahl.
Yep, that's me.
Oh, please, go ahead.
Good morning, Chairman Liebling and committee members. My name is Julie Sordahl. I'm the CEO of St. David's Center for Child and Family Development, which is a Twin Cities-based nonprofit organization offering a range of mental health services along with other therapies and social services to over 4,000 children and families. I'm here today asking you to support the stated priority of the Mental Health Legislative Network, House File 346, which will address Medicaid rates for mental health services. I'm speaking on behalf of the community of mental health providers across our state, which is serving Minnesota's most at-risk children and families. Our organizations are literally the safety net for those who have experienced deep-end trauma and have been rejected by other settings that don't have the therapeutic services to help them. We offer a continuum of interventions from outpatient clinics to intensive day treatment to residential treatment centers. We offer services that can prevent children from being hospitalized and or where they go after hospitalization as they work through the circumstances that caused the crisis. These are children who have experienced more trauma and struggle in their young lives than many of us will see in a lifetime. And when their brains are literally forming, our goal is to offer healing and corrective experiences in a transformational time in their lives, preventing terrible long-term outcomes. And we do this work under a broken payment structure in the Medicaid system, which has gone without rate increases for over a decade. While we are competing for staff with private practice clinics that are not seeing Medicaid populations, we simply must provide access to high-quality mental health care to children and families with the highest need. And yet we are buckling under a rate structure that has not kept pace with the cost of providing services. We can't retain high-quality staff that we cannot pay adequately. I ask you today to support HF 346 to increase Medicaid rates to keep these high-quality services accessible to our community's most vulnerable children and families. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck is Julie Ellis. Mr. Lehman, welcome. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair, for this opportunity to testify on the DE amendment. My name is Tom Lehman, and I'm here today on behalf of Prairie Care and Newport Health. Prairie Care is Minnesota's largest provider of child and adolescent mental health services, with locations including Maple Grove, Maplewood, Rochester, and Woodbury. Prairie Care is unique as it is one of just two for-profit hospitals in Minnesota. Last year, Prairie Care was not able to refinance its debt and needed a buyer or face closure. Newport Health stepped up and bought Prairie Care. It's a national provider of outpatient mental health and CD services for youth and young adults. It already had a presence in Minnesota because it had purchased several other Minnesota providers facing closure. Newport was able to quickly complete these purchases of providers, keeping services going and employees working. That's a good thing. But they tell me that if the financial transaction provisions in Article 3 of the bill were law last year, they would have passed on buying Prairie Care and the other Minnesota providers facing closure, because these requirements create too much uncertainty and risk. That's bad news for Minnesota mental health patients. There isn't a stampede in Minnesota to buy mental health services or mental health clinics. We have the opposite effect. People are trying to get out of mental health because of inadequate payments and other challenges. And if you can look in today's Star Tribune story about kids in hospitals for more information on this. In closing, I just want to say I've had several conversations with Representative Bierman, and I appreciate his openness. As always, I hope we can reach an agreement that doesn't harm current and future mental health patients. One suggestion is to build off Section 4 of the bill. If it makes sense to delay action on looking at just five HMOs doing conversions, I think it certainly makes sense to take a breath before we do something that affects hundreds of thousands of employees, thousands of entities, and millions of patients until we're sure we have it right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. On deck is Joel Euland. Julie Ellis, welcome.
Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Julie Ellis, and I'm the Director of Human Services for Stearns County. I'm here today representing AMC, MICA, and MAXA, at which I co-chair the Behavioral Health Committee. Counties are excited by several of the provisions in the Delete All Amendment here today. First, I'd like to highlight several of the proposed investments in the behavioral health system. We appreciate the funding for new psychiatric residential treatment facilities, startup, and specialization grants. These facilities are important to build up adequately staff and support, as they provide a critical missing piece of our continuum of care for individuals with complex acute needs. We also appreciate the consideration of additional funding for mobile crisis grants. While we have some concerns about the potential cliff of this funding, as it is one time only, immediate funding to support this critical work is appreciated and will enable us to better respond to current overwhelming needs in our communities. Counties also support funding and continued build-out of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Helpline. These funding increases will help meet the growing need for mental health outreach and crisis response on the needs on the heels of the pandemic. Excuse me. Second, I'd like to thank Chair Liebling for including the robust ask for technology modernization that was included in the governor's budget. Counties absolutely believe this modernization effort is critical to update technology systems that lag woefully behind service and program advancements and consume excessive county worker staff time. For counties, this is also an important workforce recruitment and retention concern. Many of our county workers did not grow up with green screen technology, and it requires time to train new workers on very outdated technology. This old technology is frustrating, as so much of their time is spent behind a screen and not doing the work to actually help people. We respectfully ask to work with your committee members on modifying this proposal to ensure county voice in the development and implementation of this desperately needed process. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. On deck is going to be Yang Mi Lor. And Mr. Euland, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joel Euland. I'm the Vice President of Public Affairs at UCARE and a member of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. UCARE is a nonprofit health plan serving more than 650,000 members. Almost 500,000 of our members would be impacted by Article 2, Section 10 of the bill. This is the section that terminates managed care contracts for medical assistance and Minnesota Care and moves our members to a fee-for-service. UCARE strongly opposes this section. It is difficult to state in 90 seconds or less how devastating the impact would be for our members to lose support and services and for UCARE's continued ability to serve our community. Minnesota is a nation-leading state in providing integrated services to meet the health care and social needs of our members. This has been accomplished through community partnerships and collaboration. UCARE serves many Somali, Hmong, and Hispanic members, and we have tailored our programs and hired staff to meet their unique needs. These are not supports provided under fee-for-service. All of this infrastructure, support, and investments that we've made over the last 39 years would be lost with this bill. This bill also raises many technical questions. First, would the federal government approve this change for Minnesota Care? The current federal basic health care program, basic health program rules appear to require a minimum of two health plans to ensure enrollee choice. We have not seen a fiscal note for this section of the bill, and so we have a number of other questions. Does the spreadsheet account for the interactions of the payback of the managed care payment delays, shifts, and withholds? What is the impact of the loss of the HMO premium taxes? How does the bill protection interact with the pharmacy carve-out, managed care opt-out, and Minnesota care buy-in provisions of this bill? And there are many other questions. UCARE always stands ready to partner with the state and the legislature, as we have for 39 years, but we cannot support this section. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Do we have Yang Mi Lor? Okay. Next would be Lee Grauman and then Jill King. And if Yang Mi Lor is downstairs or something, please come up and we'll fit you in. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Lee Grauman, and I'm the Director of Training and Policy at Portico HealthNet. I'm here on behalf of the 21 Navigator organizations that signed the Navigator letter previously shared with this committee. We thank the committee for their work on the bill addressing the end of continuous coverage and authorizing disbursement of funds allocated for Navigator incentive payments. This is a good start for Navigator organizations to build capacity and prepare for the resumption of renewals. However, we were disappointed that our other requests for additional funding were not included in this bill. As one in four Minnesotans will be required to renew their public program coverage over the next year, creating a coordinated and adequately funded approach will be essential to reducing unnecessary gaps in coverage, increasing equity and access, and reaching those most in need of assistance. Community-based Navigator organizations will be the front line of the healthcare coverage re-enrollment effort, and our work helps reduce the workload of counties, DHS, and MNsure. Unfortunately, the pandemic and inflation have negatively impacted many Navigator organizations. The decrease in per enrollee payments or incentive payments during the continuous coverage period, combined with stagnant Navigator funding, has caused many Navigator organizations to lay off staff and reduce capacity. The one-time funding will not be sufficient to meet the demand and cover the costs of this work. We ask for an increase in the incentive payments from $70 to $100 with a built-in cost of living adjustment, an overall annual base grant funding increase from $4 million to $10 million during the continuous coverage unwinding, an ongoing annual base grant increase from $4 million to $7 million with a built-in cost of living adjustment. Base funding has been stagnant since 2016, and this additional funding is critical to build capacity at the community level and adequately cover the cost of this important work. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jill King.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Jill King, and I am the Executive Director of Lakes Life Care Center in Forest Lake, Minnesota, and we are recipients of the Positive Alternatives Grant. I am here to oppose the repeal of the Positive Alternative Grant Program from the statute as it's being proposed in this bill. Please do not cut this program. Our center has proven to be a valuable program within our community. Public health nurses who do family home visits refer clients to us, and in turn we refer clients to their program. I spoke with one of our public health nurses recently, and she let us know that she refers 100% of her clients to us, stating that 60 to 70% of those clients use our services. She states, there are so many things that your center provides that we cannot. It is a symbiotic relationship to get families to a place where they can be confident parents. Our local medical clinics also refer their pregnant patients to us for support, resources, and early ultrasounds, specifically those that do not have insurance set up. Once ultrasounds are performed, those medical clinics ask for our records to add to their patients' records. They view us as medical professionals. We have licensed medical staff who oversee and perform all of our medical programs. We are filling the gap in care that families need while they're awaiting insurance benefits, which can sometimes take months. With the assistance of the Positive Alternative Grant Program, we are able to help provide necessary material items, especially to families and single parents who may not otherwise be able to access things like diapers and car seats. Eliminating this funding would dramatically affect our program. We may be forced to cut some of our service and in turn serve a smaller portion of our community. I am asking you not to repeal the Positive Alternatives Grant Program so we, along with other programs like ours, can continue to provide the valuable services our community needs. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So next we have Deborah Patzner, followed by Naomi Saylor, and then Dr. Brooke Hendricks. So Deborah Patzner, welcome.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Deborah Patzner. I'm from Rochester, Minnesota. Please listen carefully. Your fate is in your hands. I implore you to vote against this bill. No matter how deep you bury this F-91, the abortion aspect of this bill. God knows what you're doing. By voting in favor of this murderous abortion bill, you will have the blood of all those defenseless babies on your hands. Whether you believe in God and Jesus or not, it doesn't matter. You still will have a judgment day when you must stand before God and you will be held accountable for everything that you did, including voting in favor of such horrendous, murderous legislation. We all must stand before God when our lives are over, and God will judge us. God will ask us if we stood up for the unborn, and if we did everything we possibly could to help protect the unborn. What will your answer be? I pray that you make the right decision, and I pray this for your sake, because God's wrath will come upon those that have a part in taking the life of these innocent victims. And when I say have a part in, that includes voting to pass such an extreme, horrendous, murderous bill. And let me again remind you, it does not matter if you believe in God and Jesus or not. You will have a judgment day. So for your sake, vote no.
Thank you for your testimony. Naomi Saylor, followed by Dr. Brooke Hendricks, and then Alfred Babington Johnson. Welcome.
Thank you. Naomi Saylor, Stewartville. I am opposed to House File 91. In what sense is man the possessor of increasing power over nature? Genesis 1:28 says, "And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful and multiply, and replenish the earth and subdue it." Children are a heritage of the Lord. Exodus 1:15 says, "And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives, of which the name of one of them was Shiphrah, and the name of the other one Puah. And he said, When ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, and see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. They chose who lives and who dies." And when you fund abortion, you're funding murder from the government. The babies were born, and the government agent was choosing who they were going to kill. They had the chance to kill a baby, and they were told by the king, the government told the midwives to kill the male children. I ask you not to fund this. I ask you to not cause a certain generation of humanity to be cut off by funding these things. Repealing many safeguards that are in place is egregious. And I expect for you to make a good decision before God what you will do with generations to come, not to cut off humanity. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Brooke Hendricks and Alfred Babington Johnson, followed by Lynn Nelson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Brooke Hendricks, and I am an internal medicine resident physician at Hennepin Healthcare. I want to thank you for including medical assistance coverage for recuperative care services in your omnibus bill. I met a patient last fall who was being treated for an acute heart failure exacerbation. He had been admitted 3 times in 1 month for the same condition. My patient was in a time of transition, staying in a homeless shelter while working with a case manager to obtain affordable housing. While at the shelter, my patient had inconsistent access to restrooms, which made it difficult to take his prescribed diuretic. Without this medication, his body was unable to remove excess fluid, ultimately leading to another admission at the hospital. Throughout his admission, he shared with me frustrations about the situation, knowing he would likely end up back in the hospital if discharged to the shelter. I also recognized that staying in hospital-level care when no longer indicated can have a detrimental impact on the health of our patients. This patient would have benefited greatly from a recuperative care facility where he could resume medications with reliable access to basic resources like a restroom. He would have had the support and assistance he needed to recover fully from his acute illness rather than being set up for a repeat hospital admission. This story is not uncommon. My colleagues and I see patients in similar circumstances far too often, many of whom are in more challenging situations than the patient I referenced. 1 in 5 of our patients at Hennepin Healthcare are experiencing housing instability. We rely on savings in the 340B pharmacy program to provide services aimed at reducing and preventing hospitalization for people who are unhoused, experiencing substance use disorders, and facing food insecurities. Any changes that impact 340B savings puts our ability to reinvest savings into these services at risk. Thank you again for your support for recuperative care services and for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Alfred Babington Johnson, and followed by Lynn Nelson, and then Carrie Myers. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chair Liebling and committee. My name is Alfred Babington Johnson. I'm CEO of Stair Step Foundation and convener of His Works United, the largest ecumenical collaboration of African-American pastors in the state of Minnesota. I've come this morning to notify you and the other members of the committee that I'm scheduled to die 10 years earlier than a white male that shares my birthday. According to Las Vegas bookies and the Center for Disease Control, not only am I going to die sooner, but I'm an odds-on favorite to leave my white counterpart healthy while I'm more likely to experience heart disease, stroke, cancer, asthma, and other disabilities. This is the burden I bear labeled a health disparity. Health disparities between people of different races has been documented in the United States since the mid-1800s. Regrettably, evidence suggests that health disparities for some groups have increased in recent years. Articles published in some scholarly periodicals note that some trends that threaten to exacerbate health disparities in the U.S., including innovations that unevenly benefit privileged groups. The point is that disparate health outcomes are a fact of our lives. The good news is we have it in our power to change the situation. The bill you're considering, HF 2930, is not just a good idea. It's necessary if we have any intention to move beyond to better health outcomes for all Minnesotans. Health disparities that affect African Americans and indigenous people will not improve by ignoring them. We need actions such as the creation of an Office of African American Health and a supporting advisory council. This action will allow the ability to focus on underlying issues and inactions that allow health disparities to wreak havoc on vulnerable segments of our population. This is an appropriate action for the legislature and the state. We applaud the vision and energy of Dr. Brooke Cunningham, and we hope that you will be partners in this good work. Pass House File 2930. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Carrie Myers is on deck, and Lynn Nelson, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Lynn Nelson. I'm Director of Legislative Affairs for Blue Cross of Blue Shield of Minnesota. We're a taxable nonprofit insuring 2.5 million Minnesotans across the entire state, all 87 counties. We appreciate the inclusion of several provisions, including expanding eligibility to undocumented, providing tobacco cessation, and creating a tobacco prevention fund in this bill. We also support the goal of making healthcare affordable and appreciate the continued dialogue with Majority Leader Long on the public option provision. However, we have many concerns regarding the unintended consequences with this and numerous other provisions in the bill. For example, I read from the fiscal note, House File 96 on page 8. Any impact on current Minnesota care funding is highly speculative because of the unknown impact of introducing a public option on the individual market premiums. For this reason, this estimate assumes that any impact to the current BHP funding related to the public option is indeterminable and therefore not factored into this fiscal analysis. There are many other provisions in fiscal notes that have the same unquantifiable, not accounted for, or indeterminable. There are numerous, this is why we ask leaders to carefully weigh all of the impacts of House File 2390 in its entirety before moving forward. The cumulative impact could have a devastating effect on the state budget. It could result in a cost shift and disruptions to the commercial market, and most important, could negatively impact Minnesota's access to the care they need. Thank you.
Thank you. So we have Carrie Myers followed by Carrie Mortrud. Welcome.
Chair Liebling and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to share a brief testimony with you today. My name is Carrie Myers, and I serve as the Executive Director of Choices Pregnancy Center, a pregnancy medical center located in Greater Minnesota. that receives the Positive Alternatives Grant. I speak today on the importance of this funding for rural centers such as mine. Please do not cut the grant program and funding. The services that we provide in our community are not redundant to those provided by the county. In fact, many of the clients we serve are referred to us by the county. Health and Human Services refers parents to us who are court-ordered to obtain parenting education. The local Domestic Violence Advocacy Center refers women to us who need confirmation of pregnancy. And nurses from the local hospital refer women to us who have recently given birth and need resources such as diapers, clothing, or safe cribs for their children. We provide these services at no cost, thanks in part to funding from the Positive Alternatives Grant. Without this funding, we could not be a resource to and a partner of these agencies. In conclusion, centers like mine are doing essential work in our rural communities by offering services at no cost to the clients that we are privileged to serve. I urge you not to cut the Positive Alternatives funding. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Carrie Mortrude, followed by Mark Hughes. Welcome.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Carrie Mortrude, and I'm here on behalf of the 22,000 nurses MNA represents, which also represents 80% of all acute care nurses in Minnesota. I'm also here as a registered nurse. We commend Chair Liebling and this committee for the work and the commitment to making healthcare in Minnesota better, and MNA members send their gratitude for inclusion in this bill. I'm going to speak directly to the provisions of the bill related to Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. As a nurse who left bedside care in one of the largest acute care hospitals here in Minnesota, I cannot express how relieved I am to finally see this issue becoming a priority. As you know, we have plenty of licensed registered nurses in Minnesota, but not nearly enough willing to work in the unsafe conditions as victims of a system that does not support or protect us when we try to advocate for our patients. It is our duty and responsibility to advocate to the fullest extent possible for our patients. Despite what the opposition has told you, retaliation is real. You heard it from our members. You heard it from your nurses. This also will not turn away 70,000 Minnesotans from health care. It will provide a reliable tool for nurses to communicate with hospital leadership so that patients can be cared for with the right number of nurses, right skill level of nurses at the right time. We know very well that hospitals cannot turn patients away. Yet storing patients in hallways is not health care. The grading system by the Commissioner of Health is the only enforcement when hospitals do not staff their units safely. Why do they not want the public to know what's happening inside? Hospital bedside nurses are in crisis. Research shows that safe staffing levels increase the quality of care. Every year, we do not address this issue, more nurses leave, and more patients are at risk. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Rick Varco is on deck. Mark Hughes, welcome.
Dr. Gans told me one day that I was going to be terminally ill. I can accept that. What I told him is, you're going to die one day, and I'm going to die too. But I'm not going to die today or tomorrow. I'm going to keep going. The problem herein lies that I've had a number of these procedures. And so I went back to my primary surgeon. I began with Dr. Conroy. And at an afternoon consultation, I said, I see the real problem is that I was told to take a generic drug because of my insurance, and so on and so forth. And I said, do you believe that if I would have taken a regular drug for my body, a prescribed drug, that I would have had all these procedures? You know, Mark probably never could have cut them in half. So therefore, this leads me to this question. If I'm paying for policy out of my check, and it's a deductible, why do I not have a choice of what kind of prescription I could take, who do I go to for a doctor? Now, the other problem is my internist had to switch right in the middle of these treatments, and I'm a firm believer that you don't do that. I one time belonged to U of M Fairview. I'm a U of M alum, and belong to UVM Fairview. I now have to go to an entire clinic, and I'm not going to badmouth anybody. I one time also had Blue Cross. I hope that person's in the room. What a great policy that was. And so my point today is, if I'm paying out of my check a deductible, why do I not have a choice of two things? The prescription I take that works for my body, and also the physician that I choose to go to. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. After Rick Varco, we have Shanna Mulvihill. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Varco.
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Rick Varco. I'm testifying on behalf of my union, SEIU Healthcare Minnesota and Iowa. We represent about 50,000 workers around the state in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. We strongly support the DE amendment because it will expand access to healthcare services that our members are proud to provide. Quickly, we want to thank you for repealing the restrictions on abortion services because our members want to provide care without legal fear. We want to thank you for extending Minnesota care to all of our undocumented patients. And we want to thank you for funding the governor's $4.5 million HIV prevention initiative. Most importantly, and one of our top priorities, our members are excited because the Minnesota Care buy-in will expand access to public insurance plans with low-cost sharing. 2 weeks ago, SEIU member Kate Lynch testified here. She told you her patients would often refuse an office visit because of the high copay. She was also concerned about her sons who were going to age off her plan and have to buy insurance on the private market. Another SEIU member, Antoinetta, recently told me she worries that she could be forced off Minnesota Care if her PCA wages grow too much, and there are a lot of Minnesotans facing a similar cliff. The buy-in will provide more people a better option. We hope in the future to expand options for small businesses to help pay for an employee to buy into Minnesota Care, but this is a great bill, and we hope you vote yes. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So on deck is Darlene Kopeski. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Shanna Mulvihill, Executive Director of Mental Health Minnesota and co-chair of the Mental Health Legislative Network. There are a number of policy and funding provisions related to mental health in this bill that we support, but my colleagues at the network either have or will be addressing those today. So I'm going to keep my comments focused on the implementation of the 988 Suicide and Crisis Lifeline in Minnesota. Approximately half of suicides in Minnesota are completed by those who have no known history of mental illness or treatment. An easy-to-remember and well-publicized phone number that provides a source of help in a given moment of need can and does save lives. Short-term federal funding has helped our Lifeline centers in Minnesota build capacity to meet the increased need and answer a much higher number of calls in-state. However, this is not ongoing funding, and there is a need to create a stable and sustainable funding model to support 988 response long-term. And there are several letters from Lifeline centers in Minnesota that confirm this need as well in your packets. The federal 988 legislation allows states to use a telecom fee for crisis center operations and related services. We greatly appreciate the inclusion of a new telecom fee in this bill to build and sustain 988 operations in Minnesota. We do ask, however, for a total of $8 million in one-time funds in FY24 rather than the $4.9 million currently included, which would help our state build capacity in 988 response prior to the implementation of this fee. These costs reflect reality. Our mental health system across the country is far behind any emergency response to a physical health condition, and we need to address mental health crises with appropriate expertise and resources. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. So let's see, on deck will be Rachel Copeland-Nunn and Darlene Kopeski. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Darlene Kopeski, and I'm the Executive Director of Cradle of Hope. And I also served on Governor Waltz's statewide infant mortality strategy team. I'm here to testify in opposition to repealing the Positive Alternatives for Abortion grant program. Cradle of Hope is a non-political, non-religious, statewide nonprofit organization. We help 3,000 moms and babies in crisis throughout Minnesota each year. We provide rent assistance to prevent evictions, family homelessness, and so families can stay in their homes during a pregnancy and after birth. We also provide safe sleep training and distribute over 200 portable cribs each month so every baby has a safe place to sleep. Positive Alternatives funding enables Cradle of Hope to support, encourage, and assist 2,000 pregnant families and about 1,000 families with babies each year. In order to ensure that everyone in Minnesota has access to the support they need, we partner with 204 agencies, including 7 of the 11 Minnesota tribal nations. Our partners include the County Public Health Family Home Visiting Nurses Program and 64 of the 87 Minnesota counties. They rely on us to support, they rely on our support to meet the needs of the families they serve. We also partner with 31 hospitals and medical clinics, 19 shelters, and more. Losing Positive Alternatives funding would cut our budget in half and cut the number of families we serve in half. We might have to cut our support to the 7 Minnesota tribal nations and the County Public Health Home Visiting Nurses Program. We might not be able to help families in rural Minnesota and may have to limit our statewide support to families in crisis. Any cuts would be dire. We strongly encourage you not to repeal the Positive Alternatives Grant Program, and thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. So on deck is Jim Lee Palin, and next is Rachel Copeland Nunn. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rachel Copeland Nunn. I'm a patient of Options for Women East Pregnancy Medical Clinic in St. Paul. Through their prenatal program, I've had 2 successful pregnancies, deliveries, and postpartum care. Today, I have 3 beautiful, healthy children whom I raised as a single parent, and the 2 youngest boys are here because of the medical team at Options for Women East. I'm asking you today to not repeal the Positive Alternatives Grant, which will eliminate funds from Options for Women East that are used to support pregnancy medical services, including a full prenatal care program, which I greatly benefited from. The greatest gift my family has received and continues to keep is health care. When I first came to Options for Women East, I didn't have medical insurance. This was a barrier for me receiving medical services. Options East was able to give me medical care even without insurance. The staff welcomed me into their prenatal program. Through that and other services they provided, I received medical care, doctor and nurse visits, ultrasounds, pregnancy and parenting education, baby supplies, and community resources, and made relationships with staff that continue today. This helped my family greatly in times of major need. The staff also worked with me to apply for insurance so I could continue to provide for my growing family. I was blessed to have a doctor who cared about me and my baby, me and my baby as whole people. But the care and compassion they offer goes beyond their medical services. They help foster relationships that are also needed during a pregnancy and after delivery. Without Positive Alternative Grant funding, they would not be able to offer critical prenatal care for women like me. And without Options for Women East, I would not have been able to take care of my baby's immediate needs like clothes, diapers, wipes, bottles, breastfeeding supplies, car seat, stroller, pack and play, with safe education.
I have all to ask you to so wrap up, more. Please.
Okay. Today, I'm still connected with the doctor, and I continue to receive care for my entire family, and I keep my insurance. As a black mother raising my babies on my own, places like this are extremely needed in my community. I know I'm not alone in this situation with working and trying to keep everything together. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Jim Lee Palin, and then Deborah Herman Judah is on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Jim Lee Palin. I'm with the Minnesota Association of Community Mental Health Programs. We represent 35 community-based mental health programs and agencies across Minnesota. Our mission is to serve all who come to us seeking mental and chemical health services, regardless of their insurance status, their ability to pay, or where they live. We are also a very active member of the Mental Health Legislative Network. Thank you for this opportunity to testify on your health omnibus bill provisions. To start, thank you so much for the inclusion of an increase to our outpatient mental health and SUD rates under medical assistance, the proposal that was in House File 346. Fixing our Medicaid reimbursement system is foundational to solving our mental health crisis in the state. We appreciate your inclusion of the telehealth extension to 2025 for both commercial products and medical assistance. Thank you for including recuperative care, tobacco cessation services, and product coverages under medical assistance. We appreciate you addressing our mental health residential
crisis, or I apologize, our mental health residential cost-based rates as well. And thank you for supporting psychiatric residential treatment facilities and adult day treatment rates and mobile crisis funding for mobile crisis grants. There are also several provisions of our mental health and behavioral health priorities that are not included in the omnibus. We hope there will be more opportunities to connect with the committee on these areas in coming months, specifically covered room and board services in residential mental health care for Minnesota Care enrollees, a single statewide rate structure that keeps up with pace of costs for behavioral health homes, and for certified community behavioral health clinics, some policy clarifications, re-entry into the national demonstration, payment updates, and a transition from this certified program into a license. To close, we also just want to state that higher reimbursements that do keep up with pace that for the cost of services in mental health are very critical, and we hope that there's opportunity to continue to work with you on that. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Deborah Herman Judah and then Megan Peterson is on deck. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, representatives. My name is Deborah Herman Judah. I'm a registered nurse and a women's health nurse practitioner. My entire nursing career, spanning 15 years, has focused on reproductive health care. Throughout my career, I've had the opportunity to train and work in states where nurse practitioners, physician assistants, and certified nurse midwives provide abortions. This experience informed my efforts to change our laws in Minnesota. I've been working toward this change since 2018. Most recently as witness in Doe versus Minnesota. Minnesota's current statute names physicians only as abortion providers. It also references unconstitutional and outdated practices such as dual parental notification and the 24-hour waiting restriction. These statutes must change to reflect the summary judgment of Minnesota's district court. These statutes must change because they create an ambiguous and precarious legal climate for providers like myself, nurse practitioners, and nurse midwives providing abortion care. Statute 145.412, Subdivision 1 states, it shall be unlawful to willfully perform an abortion unless the abortion is performed by a physician licensed to practice medicine pursuant to Chapter 147 or a physician in training under the supervision of a licensed physician. And Subdivision 4 states, a person who performs an abortion in violation of this section is guilty of a felony. Unless our statutes change, until our statutes change, many of my nurse colleagues cannot and will not provide this care. Their attorneys won't advise it. Their employers won't allow it. I urge you to pass HF 2930 because those of us doing this care, people helping people obtain abortions, we need clarity. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for your testimony. Megan Peterson, and then on deck is Nasra Hussein. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning. I guess it's afternoon now. Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Megan Peterson. I'm the Executive Director of Gender Justice. We're a legal and policy advocacy organization dedicated to advancing gender equity through the law. And I wanted to start by celebrating the tremendous progress the legislature has made in just the past 3 months in advancing and defending reproductive freedom. I applaud the champions of reproductive rights, justice, and health care access who have acted swiftly and decisively in passing the PRO Act and advancing additional legislation to make its promise real. And I'm here to urge you to keep going. Specifically, I'm here on behalf of the organization and coalition I represent to voice our strong support for the Health, Finance, and Policy Omnibus Bill. We are grateful for the inclusion of provisions from the Reproductive Freedom Codification Act that would remove unconstitutional, outdated, unjust, and harmful anti-abortion statutes from our state legislative code. Some of these provisions repeal statutes that were found unconstitutional last year. Lifting these restrictions had an immediate positive impact on patients, including Minnesotans and people from many other states across the country who have lost meaningful access to reproductive health care in their home states. Repealing the restrictions would also align our laws more closely with the values of Minnesotans. A strong majority of Minnesotans support expanding access to abortion, and they are very much looking to you to lead. A recent statewide survey found that 75% of Minnesota voters want people to make their own decisions about abortion without government interference, and 68% want our laws restricting abortion rights and access repealed. Thank you so much for your time, and please pass this law.
Thank you for your testimony. Just a little programming note here. We're going to continue. I think we can get through the list. So thank you, everyone, for your brevity and for your cooperation and getting to the table quickly. So the next on deck is Ann Fredrickson, and then after that is John Tribbett. So Anasra Hussein, welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. My name is Nasra Hussein. I'm a manager at Children's Dental Services. It is a 104-year-old nonprofit providing cultural tailored dental care and education to 37 at-risk underserved Minnesota annual in 66 Minnesota counties. My work with CDS includes connecting patients with emergency care under general anesthesia, working closely with the finances, and helping create a culturally tailored environment for both patients and staff members. Thank you for including community solutions in Section 125 of House File 2930. CDS is the current grantee of the Community Solutions Grant Program through the Minnesota Department of Health, and I have seen firsthand how valuable this program is. We support this work because it has been incredibly important for us helping expand our culturally tailored and translated comprehensive dental care to the at-most risk communities across Minnesota, including immigrants and refugees, children, pregnant women and people, and family members of all ages. Under Community Solutions funding, CDS has been able to serve over 3,000 additional patients. Sustained expanding funding is necessary to continue our important work as well as other Community Solution grantees in order to make concrete changes that build and sustain positive outcomes in the future. It is imperative that communities are able to access this funding beyond the pilot. We are thankful for the inclusion of the Community Solutions Grant Program in the House Health, Finance, and Policy Omnibus bill, and we urge the committee to continue this program that has changed the lives of 1,000 underserved, culturally diverse communities across the state of Minnesota. Thank you for your time and consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. So Ann Fredrickson, and then John Tribbett, and then Michelle Sancartier. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Annie Fredrickson, and I'm the Executive Director of Alpha Women's Center, a pro-life pregnancy help clinic based in Prior Lake. We're the only mobile pregnancy clinic in Minnesota, and we provide services from a 31-foot customized RV. Our mobile clinic allows us to serve women in multiple locations in Scott, Carver, and Hennepin counties. I'm here today to encourage you to reinstate funding for the Positive Alternatives Grant, as well as to bring awareness to the excellent resources provided by my organization and others like us. Under the direction of a medical doctor, our registered nurses and sonographers provide free medical services to our patients, who are mostly low-income, uninsured women. In addition to medical care and material supplies, we offer every patient 10 free sessions with a licensed family therapist or life coach to help her truly make positive changes in her life. Our organization saves the state tens of thousands of dollars a year by providing no-cost medical care and mental health services. We provide a necessary resource to the county since some of our patients are referred to us by public health nurses, and we frequently deliver diapers, formula, and car seats to Scott County and tribal caseworkers who reach out to us to help their clients. Instead of increasing taxpayer funding for abortion, I urge you to increase the Positive Alternatives Grant and support pregnancy help clinics. Do only wealthy or middle-class women deserve the right to keep and raise their babies? When our policies encourage abortion for women with financial problems or troubled relationships, we don't solve anything. After an abortion, those women still go home to financial problems and broken relationships, but with the added pain of abortion. Let's focus on policies that truly do offer positive alternatives to abortion, and that includes supporting pregnancy help clinics and the many important resources that we offer to the community. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. John Tribbett, and then Michelle Sancartier, and then Robert Hyder. Welcome.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Tribbett. I'm a service area director at Avivo. We provide services for people experiencing homelessness in our Ending Homelessness program. I oversee a variety of programs, including the street outreach team, Avivo Village, and a number of housing programs. We are on the front line of the opioid and fentanyl crisis in our community. We see the devastation firsthand, and so therefore I'm here today to support HF 2930, the Comprehensive Drug Overdose and Morbidity Prevention Act, specifically Strategy 3, Overdose Prevention Hubs, along with syringe service programs, and along with HF 2041, which would provide a legal structure for harm reduction services. Also here, in a personal note, as a former injection drug user who received services through a harm reduction program almost 25 years ago, I attribute the fact that I'm here alive testifying in front of you to the services I received there. We have soaring deaths throughout the country with overdoses. In Minnesota, the MDH morbidity or mortality report indicated that overdoses are the primary cause of death for people experiencing homelessness at a rate 10 times greater than the general population. It's a racial disparity issue. African Americans in 2019 and were twice as likely, Native Americans seven times more likely to die of an overdose death. At one Avivo location, we have reversed over 110 overdoses in a little less than 2.5 years. Sadly, we have lost people throughout our programs. We see the death and devastation on a daily basis in the community. Funding would continue to offer support to begin to meet the need. The need is vast. It's great. We need more funding to provide life-saving naloxone, safe use supplies, medical support, and access to substance use disorder treatment. And really, what this ultimately comes down to is love through legislation to provide support for some of the most marginalized members of our community. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Michelle Sancartier, welcome. And then Robert Hyder, and then Shayla Walker. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Liebling, members of the committee. My name is Michelle Sancartier, and I'm the Director of Public Policy and Advocacy with Minnesota Social Service Association. MSSA is an organization of over 4,000 professionals across the state who work in all areas of human services. We're thankful for the inclusion of House File 1494 in House File 2930, which would provide grants to human service organizations to invest in workplace safety measures. This provision will help address a critical component of human services provider burnout and the workforce shortage by providing human services agencies with the resources they need to ensure the safety of their employees. However, while we're grateful for these provisions because they were combined with provisions for similar grants in hospital and healthcare settings, we want to request the original funding amount in both of these bills, which in total would be $20 million in fiscal year 24 and $20 million in fiscal year 25. This will account for the calculated need in both healthcare and human services industries. Workplace safety issues are a systemic problem, and we want to make sure we're meeting the need for the greatest number of agencies possible. Lastly, due to the combination of these proposals, we do anticipate a forthcoming proposed amendment to address implementation concerns, as settings will vary widely, and we'll work on this in collaboration with the Safety Coalition and the healthcare, the folks behind the healthcare bill. Additionally, in my role as co-convener of the This Is Medicaid Coalition, which is a diverse coalition of more than 50 nonpartisan organizations across Minnesota partnering to protect and improve Medicaid, I want to call your attention to a few key provisions we're thankful for and those we urge you to consider. While we're incredibly thankful for the inclusion of continuous medical assistance eligibility for children, we ask that you make additional considerations, which we've outlined in our letter. In particular, we want you to consider inclusion of continuous eligibility for all MA enrollees, including adults. This helps strengthen the benefit to children and families as well and offers an off-ramp. Thank you so much for the opportunity to share our support for this bill and the transformative provisions that you've included.
Thank you for your testimony. Robert Hyder and Shayla Walker. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Robert Hyder, and I'm the legislative director at Take Action Minnesota. We are a multiracial statewide people's organization with 15 years of experience working on state health care policy. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on behalf of House File 2930. This bill takes us in the right direction, and there are a few crucial provisions that we want to highlight today. First, Article 2, Section 24, the Minnesota Care and Immigrant Inclusion Act. Our health and well-being are tied together, and every person needs and deserves health care without exception. We strongly support these provisions to include people without status in Minnesota Care. Second, we strongly support the Minnesota Care public option to expand affordable and high-quality health care. Since 2017, our state has spent over $1 billion shoring up the failing individual market through so-called reinsurance. Each year, the federal government spends hundreds of millions of dollars subsidizing Minnesota health insurance companies on the individual market. This provision provides a path forward, so we are using state and federal dollars as well as enrollee contributions toward a better, more affordable public health insurance option. This provision would close coverage gaps and offer temporary subsidies to individuals while the public option is being implemented. We would like to see inclusion for small employers to participate as well. We support Article 1, Section 23, which eliminates managed care organizations from public programs. MCOs have contributed to the increase in costs while failing to deliver the care that we all need and deserve. Lastly, we support the provisions that repeal restrictions on abortion care. Thank you for continuing the work to truly protect access to reproductive health. We urge you to support this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is Shayla Walker here? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me. My name is Shayla Walker. I'm the executive director of Our Justice. Our Justice is a reproductive justice organization and the abortion fund. We are the largest abortion fund in Minnesota, and we've been around since before Roe v. Wade. We have been seeing an increase of people traveling to Minnesota for care, and we have also been seeing an increase of people who have Medicaid access not being able to access their care due to low reimbursement rates for Medicaid. This has shaken the ecosystem of the abortion care providers, because a lot of abortion care providers can no longer take Medicaid due to the fact that the reimbursement rates are not high enough. So right now we have about 9 providers who can offer abortion care, independent providers, and Planned Parenthood who can offer abortion care. And out of all of those providers, only 2 of them can take Medicaid for telehealth. Telehealth is one of the more used services for people of low income, people who are in rural areas. So, yeah, they only have 2 options. They have to wait for one of those 2 providers to become available for them, for patients to use their Medicaid. And so I encourage you all to increase the Medicaid reimbursement rates so that patients can truly have a choice. Due to Doe v. Gomez, the ruling back in 1995 that Our Justice helped secure in the state of Minnesota, it says that Minnesota has an obligation to pay for abortions through the Medicaid program. What is a Medicaid program if the only 2 clinics, or a few clinics, can take Medicaid? So we do highly encourage you all to increase the Medicaid wages so that, you know, Our Justice and donors to Our Justice are not paying the fees for the patients. Over the last year, we paid out $20,000 for Medicaid recipients alone.
Okay. So. Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to call again Bethlehem Yawala-Work. And the other person, Yangmi Lor. Okay. So I don't see either of them here. So that completes our list. So we will meet again tomorrow at 10:30 for markup of the bill, and there's an amendment deadline at 5 p.m. And I know that our nonpartisan staff are working very hard to get amendments together. They did ask us to get them into them earlier today so they can do that work and get the amendments in by 5, but in fact, the amendment deadline is 5 p.m. So with that, thank you, everyone, for your testimony and for your attendance and listening to each other's testimony. And with that, we are adjourned.